Channel 2 over. Channel 2 over. Beginning of the visit with Debbie with Rick this Saturday after supper, the 18th of November, 72. Channel 2 over. And beginning of the visit with Debbie with Rick this Saturday after supper, the 18th of November, 72. Channel 2 over. And beginning of the visit with Debbie with Rick this Saturday after supper, the 18th of November, 72. Channel 2 over. And beginning of the visit with Debbie with Rick this Saturday after supper, the 18th November, 72. 72.
Oh, she never liked to. I think she's very self-conscious because she has an English accent when she speaks, and the French side of the family has made her feel very self-conscious about it, I think. Even though she speaks very good French, and she's been speaking French for 30 years, 25 years, but she's still very self-conscious about it.
It was nothing that she said in the letter that made Debbie see this. It was just when Debbie started looking at her, she said.
Just came to you.
I was trying to think about, well, the one thing that she did that used to just fascinate me was she never would waste anything. I've never seen anybody conserve and hoard things as much as she did. And she hated the idea of the bread going to waste. And so she used to, that we'd get fresh bread every morning, these long baguettes, and we wouldn't finish them, and they'd go stale in a couple hours. And so she'd take the stale bread. Well, before it got stale, she'd take the bread in the morning and she'd slice it up and toast it and make hard toast out of it. And no one ever ate it. She just kept making hard toast and making hard toast and making hard toast. She kept filling up these tins, and you'd go into there was a cupboard where they kept tins of biscuits for tea, and you'd go in and open up a couple of tins and they'd just be filled with hard bread. And nobody ever ate it, except every once in a while she'd bring it out and try to get someone to eat it. And nobody would eat it but Dan Dan. And so she'd put it back again. And pretty soon she'd filled up all the tins in the house with this hard bread. And she had to start in on plastic bags. And she had a plastic bag going that was about this high when she went back to England. And I don't know whatever happened to all that hard bread. I think it went to the zoo, to the birds in the zoo finally. Because you just don't give toast to a Frenchman. They just won't eat it.
Oh.
Got to be fresh bread, and she couldn't get anybody to eat it.
But those little baguettes for breakfast wouldn't stay fresh long.
No, they go stale in a couple of hours.
Yes.
They have big air holes like that.
Yes.
They're made with water, not with milk.
Yeah.
And it's not heavy bread at all, and it doesn't get stale. It gets hard.
Yeah.
It gets so hard you can bounce it. In about 2 hours, it gets that hard. So they have to buy fresh bread for every meal. Unless they toast it and make hard bread out of it and fill up all the tins in the house. But Dan Dan was the only person that ever did that. And that was really the only waste. The bread was the only thing that her daughter ever wasted. She never wasted very much either. But that was partially because she'd go and shop every day for what we'd eat that day. She'd go shopping twice a day for food. She'd go in the morning for noon, and she'd go at night for dinner. And we'd eat everything up. And if what we didn't eat up, we'd eat up the next day. So there was never anything to waste, because she spent all day making sure that she planned it well enough so that we wouldn't leave anything over.
Twice a day.
It took most of her time. Well, she'd just go down to the village mostly, but it took a lot of time.
Did you ever go with her?
I went with her once or twice, but I wasn't home usually to go. She went. I was never home at noon, and I wouldn't. She'd usually go before I'd get home. In the afternoon. But that's eating in France just takes up eating and getting ready to eat and clearing up after you eat takes the whole day, especially on Sunday.
Well, look, Debbie, it comes back to me when I eat with Mrs. Guthrie or somebody in the countryside. That food they have, well, you think it's too much and it's wasteful and all like that. But I tell you what it does. It makes you feel at home. Just never get nervous. And I can remember that. Just that good food. And you didn't have to have great quantities of it. We used to have, at night for supper, we used to have little fresh green onions out of the garden. And a little meat. Ham and ham gravy, and warm up some biscuits, and have some buttermilk. Well, you say that's not much. Well, it's enough. It's a good bit, especially when it all tastes good. And you know, I can't remember ever getting up from the table unsatisfied. Never. The French ought to be satisfied.
Oh, they're worn out. It takes them so long to get through. They don't eat much for every course. They just eat a very little bit. You don't try to eat a whole lot at the beginning of the meal or you won't make it to the end. You have to save enough room so that you can eat something at every course. So you just eat a little bit for the first couple of courses. And then you don't want anything for the third and fourth and fifth courses because you're starting to get full. But they don't eat a lot. They don't eat a lot at all. Especially they don't eat much meat. Really small pieces of meat. Much at all. That's how I knew I was coming back to America when I got on the plane. It was an American airline, and they gave us two big fat pieces of meat. And I knew it was an American plane. Because in Europe, nobody would eat that much meat.
They wouldn't need it to start with.
Yeah. They just aren't used to it. We Americans are the ones who eat so much meat.
Well, you know, Guy was always saying that the Chinese they eat just meat to flavor it.
Yes, I can't remember, unless you go to a restaurant and pay a lot of money, you see, and then you eat more of everything than you want. But at home with Madam and Doctor, you just reach over and get just enough meat to put taste to the rice and the vegetable. A little taste.
They have meat just to put a little taste in the sauce in France.
Yeah.
In the sauce. Vincent made me a one time a sauce for veal. And it was such a simple thing to do. And he was like his grandmother. He just made this tremendous big production out of making this sauce that all it was some mustard and some water and some cream that he just stirred up in the pan and put over the meat. But he worked at it for 15 minutes just to get it just right. And he thought that he'd produced this work of art. I mean, it was really a work of art, the way he blended the mustard and the cream. He went and got the cream out of the top of the milk carton, because the milk always had about this much cream in the top of it, stuck on the top of the carton. It came in a carton, looks like a sugar box, about that high. And then you pour the milk out, and be all this yellow cream just stuck up in the top. I usually gave it to the cat. Unless Vincent was making sauce.
Well, what is it, Debbie, you, what do you miss about the French eating? The bread?
Oh, I miss the bread, and I just miss the havoc on the table.
Yeah.
I miss that. Oh, but this is nothing. This is nothing. This isn't, I mean, there are no crumbs on the table.
Yeah.
And that, I miss all that, and I miss eating. Like, I eat like this sometimes here, with my hands on the table, or I forget to switch my fork back.
Yeah.
You know, I just eat with my fork in one hand, and I catch myself doing it, and I think, whoops, you're wrong country, and I switch back again.
Yeah.
And I miss being able to do that. It's much better if you can sort of hold
well,
on
you
to
know
your
that
plate
is
to eat.
Something, isn't it?
They hang on to their plate, you know, they sort of eat like this. And
oh.
Just get right up there with it.
Yeah. You know, it's shameful. I never saw anyone eat like that, you know. Looks like I run into it somewhere, doesn't it?
Well, we ate in France all around. What was the matter with it? We just weren't looking.
We just didn't see.
You didn't see him eat like that? Oh, you saw people not just eat with a fork in one hand.
Well, you see, I just didn't see. I haven't been looking but a year or two. I had that old academic focus. I could just cut things out, you see. I didn't have to worry about them things.
Well, you know, he took his oatmeal to the kitchen and all the pensions we lived in, or anywhere else we were.
Say, I don't see that goes anywhere.
Well, I was just thinking. We had our own way a lot.
No, I had that, I wasn't interested in food, you see. Never been interested in food.
Not even in France?
Oh, no.
Food
or wine or any of those things. No, I just discarded a great deal of, great many things. Great many. I didn't go many places.
Well, that was, I must have had one of the best introductions to French cooking that I could possibly have had. When we stayed in January, we stayed in a sort of resort hotel that was, well, it was very small. It only had 12 rooms, but it had a very, very famous restaurant. And the man that ran the restaurant used to be the patisserie chef for George VI of England. He used to work in Buckingham Palace and make all the cakes and everything for George. And we just had incredible meals in that pension. We were on demi-pension, so we just had the menu every night. And that, you know, some nights were better than others, but usually it was so much food. We'd eat everything. We never thought to cut out a course. We ate everything. And consequently, we'd make ourselves practically sick every night because there was so much food. And after a while, we stopped eating cheese. That was our great concession to not eating so much food, was that we wouldn't have the cheese course. There are usually 5 courses to a French meal. And cheese is the thing you have right before you have dessert or fruit or whatever you're going to have at the end. And we finally decided that if we didn't have cheese, that would make all the difference, that we wouldn't be so full when we got up from dinner. So we stopped having a little piece of cheese like that and thought that it would make all the difference. And of course, we still felt it's full because the cheese didn't make any difference at all. What we shouldn't have had was the soup and the second course, which was the really rich course usually. Oh, we used to have the stuff endive with ham and put cream sauce and wine over it. And it would be so rich that by the time you were through, you couldn't even think about anything else, and then they'd walk in with a steak or something like that for you to eat. And by the time you'd finished the steak, you shouldn't have, by rights, thought about any more food. But we'd go on and have something else to eat, too. We'd eat fruit or dessert or something. And
you didn't see them?
Mm-hmm. And the Osbournes were there with us.
Who were they?
They were some friends of Phoebe's from Cleveland. And Dr. Osborne was a retired physician. And Mrs. Osborne taught French. And she had a friend in Nice. That's why we went to Nice. Because she had a friend in Nice that she wanted to go back to France so that she could speak French without an American accent. And she thought that if she could talk to her friend in Nice for a couple hours a day, that would help a lot. So that's why we went to Nice. We thought it would be good to be with them.
Would Ms. Osborne go with you?
Yes. For January, they went.
They were there for the first part of the time you were there?
Yes. We went over, we met them. We were supposed to be in Nice by New Year's Eve so that we could all have New Year's Eve together in Nice.
Yeah.
Thought New Year's in Nice sounded euphoric or something. Revels on the Riviera.
But then you didn't stay.
No, we went then. They left in the 1st of February, and we went up to northern France.
Well, so they didn't, Ms. Osborne didn't have any connection with what you did later,
no? No, not at all. She just for 4 weeks.
She
beginning.
Just got you a Nice, that's all.
She got us to Nice.
Just like Wordsworth got me on the Loire. The shortest place I ever saw. Except they still had all those beautiful little restaurants.
I never went there.
But they were wasted on me. They had nobody to play with, you see, work with. I wouldn't condescend to have a good food. See, I'm an old oat. I eat oats.
I went to the Chateau Circuit, you know where that is?
Yeah.
And the restaurant. He's fun to go with, though.
Limited way.
You go with you on bicycle trips, and then you'll see so many things. You wonder where in the world your eyes were on a bicycle trip.
So you just hit it off then, didn't you, with that little hotel?
Oh, yes, with the food in the hotel, I did.
Well, how did you ever tear yourself away?
Well, I knew that if we went to northern France, we'd eat even better.
Oh, Debbie.
Because in northern France, they eat 10 times as much as you eat in southern France. I ate so much in 2 days when we went to Normandy that I got sick, and I had to stop eating for a while. That was because the people that we were visiting were, they thought that they really, here we were in France and that we should eat every Norman delicacy that there was to eat. And in 2 days, we did eat a lot. And I really got pretty sick for a day. And then after that, it was all right. Because we went to Chartres then. And
I don't think of you as being intemperate.
Oh, I can be.
You can be.
With food?
Oh, yes.
Good.
I'm intemperate with a lot of things. A lot of things.
Well, you were intemperate in that, using the French language, as if there wouldn't be any more after this year. But I didn't know you were intemperate.
No, I never thought there wouldn't be any more French language. I just wanted to learn it all in 3 months. And I couldn't do it.
Well, you could. Well, you just didn't get to use it enough, did you?
No, not nearly enough.
not me.
Now, what is that word you used, you see, about being detached when you're over there? You don't have any feeling of duty, and all you are. What word was that you used a time or two in your letters? You see, you got an immunity. You see, as a foreigner, you have an immunity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very pleasant.
Well,
I remember.
It's pleasant, but it's very frustrating, too. Because you can't, as long as you're a foreigner, you can't really enter in to, I couldn't anyway, because I didn't speak French well enough. I couldn't enter into enough. And that's why I wanted to learn a whole lot of French right away and be able to talk to people more than just asking them, telling them what I wanted, you know, and ordering things and talking about the weather and that kind of thing. And I didn't learn that fast enough until, and I got fouled up in that school. Just fouled up in that school where they kept telling me I talked like an American for 3 months until after the exam. And then that was all right. Then I could just speak fine after that. I didn't care.
Is Phoebe a traveler?
Yeah, Phoebe, my godmother. She likes to travel. Well, she likes to travel. She's traveling with somebody. She doesn't like to travel alone. And she loves to travel if she can paint. But if she can't, if she's going so fast that she can't stop to paint, she gets frustrated. She likes to take. We went through Italy too fast. We only stayed 2 weeks, and that was just frustrating for her, I think, because there were a lot of things that she wanted to paint, and she couldn't, because it was cold, for one thing. We went at the wrong time of the year for her. She couldn't sit outside to paint. It was much too cold. It never got warm in Nice.
Well, all the time she was there, it was cold.
All the time it didn't get warm all the time
she
I was there.
Went right in the dead of winter, didn't she?
Right in the middle of winter. It couldn't have been a worse time. Summertime's not a good time to go to Nice, but it's a better time to go somewhere in France.
Yes.
And Nice was cold.
Nice was freezing until I left in June and it was cold. Well, I thought you went swimming in the wintertime on the Riviera. I thought the water was warm and it was like Florida or something.
So that's all the movies say it is.
It's freezing. People wore fur coats. Big fur coats all the time.
Oh, you were there?
Yes. And I wore a raincoat. I thought it was going to be warm and I took a raincoat. And it was so cold. It was just freezing. We used to put on, especially when we went up to Paris in February, we'd put on everything we had. 2 pairs of socks and everything we had, all our shirts and everything, and get all bundled out like this and still be cold.
Yeah.
Well, I can understand that because I've never been in Paris and I wasn't cold.
You were writing back here under false colors. You should have put yourself under the right heading. You see, but you just you just flat headed and never say.
Went the wrong time.
The whole shebang.
Went backwards.
Yeah.
Of course.
The whole shebang.
That's right. The whole thing was backwards.
Yeah. And here you're writing some pretty civilized letters.
Even the school was backwards. I thought, I wrote to them and I said that I wanted to, well, I went in January to the school. And I said that, did they have a course for foreigners, that I had written and gotten a book about courses for foreign, gotten a book about it, courses for foreign students. And they said, oh, yes, there's one starting in March. And I thought, well, if it's starting in March, March 1 is the first day of the course. Well, no, that wasn't quite the case. That was the middle of the year, March. The year had started in October. And that was the middle of the year. And so the first lecture that I walked into was the middle of the year. And he was talking about punctuation or something like that.
Yeah, interesting subject.
Uh-huh. and I just sort of sat there and I thought, now this is funny. Why didn't he spend the first hour of the first class welcoming us to the course? That's what they're supposed to do. Why is he talking about punctuation? He's forgotten something somewhere. And it took me about 2 weeks to realize what had happened, that I was in the middle of the year, and that I'd missed the first year, the first part of the year.
Yeah. See, this Rick's chair, he's sitting over there, uncomfortable. what does your... What does your mom and your papa know about what you did over there? Do you tell them?
Yeah, I talked a lot about it. I don't know how much, what they know too much.
You talk about it?
Mm-hmm. When I came back in August, I talked about it. We haven't talked about it since I've been back now.
Well, you weren't here long.
They're interested in the future now. That's what we've been talking about this week. Off and on.
Well, what audience do you have?
Not much, and I never got a chance to talk very much to my friends, my peers. Very much about going to France. I never really had time to listen to it very much, except Russell, because she was there with me. And we talked about it a lot. But she has a lot to tell about it, too, because she was there for part of the time.
Well, did she get things all backwards like you did?
Oh, no. She's very... she kept a lot of lists. She'd make a list at the end of every day of all. For a while, she was making a list of all the things that we do every day. And then she started listing the food. She liked the food as much as I did. I had
she did.
Oh, I had a willing student in Russell. We ate our way across France and drank because she wanted to try out the different wine in every place we stopped. And so she made a list of the food for a long time. A lot, the different food that we'd eat. One night I remember we had baby radishes for dinner. And in France you eat radishes with bread, with butter. Not necessarily bread, you can, but you put butter on the radish and eat it with butter. Because the radishes have such a strong taste that you're supposed to have butter on it. That's what Mr. Yunow told me. And I wasn't going to try it. I said, you're crazy if you don't eat butter on radishes. I didn't tell
Sounds
him.
Terrible.
I didn't tell him he was crazy because I didn't know the word, but I thought he was. But I tried it and it wasn't bad. The only thing I didn't like the whole time I was in France was raw artichokes. They were hard to eat.
Out of the garden.
Out of the garden. We'd cut the little tiny artichokes and eat them raw. Vincent loved them raw. But I thought they were too hard to chew, and they didn't taste like anything, so they weren't worth eating. And if something doesn't taste like anything, it's not worth chewing on for a long time.
Where did you get interested in food and choice?
Oh,
like these. One of the most extraordinary things I ever saw. It haunted me. It was some people my age when I was young there. They would sit over there in the Willis Street where the students played, you know, and play bridge. Young people playing bridge. You see, I just simply, it haunted me. And food, you see, food is something for old people to. When they ain't got nothing else to do. Every day. Every day. It's the heart of the day, Faye. No horses?
The dog Sunday afternoon eating. Debbie.
Oh. Well, you see, I missed out on all that. My first trip there, I stayed with Frau Rademacher. Herr Rademacher was there. He'd spent the war years in prison, as a prisoner of war in China. I don't know if he ever got over there, I don't know, but he did. And we lived out of that garden. And potato soup, it was just angelic. Meal after meal after meal, potato soup. And it always tasted just like you hadn't had any all summer, all spring. Potatoes right out of the hill, you see. Now, I forget what else we had. All I remember is potato soup, you see.
Little. Yeah. Little. Wait, how is it that in
Hoboken? But now that, that's all I eat is potato soup. Yes, I went around with my little green German dictionary in one hand. I got so I could do that, and Thomas used it too. Talk along, look up a word. And you didn't use a dictionary, did you?
No.
You know these little...
I had one.
...market vets thing. I used that all the time. See, when I went to Germany, I studied French, but I never studied German. I went to Herr Rose's course class there in Cornell. I guess I went for a week or two, a week or 10 days. Long enough to I could kind of learn how to pronounce it. And then I found that pronunciation in German was no great item. Nothing like French. See, I never could pronounce French or hear French either. That's one reason. And that's all the German I knew. And I had Rose's grammar, and I read that on the boat over. But mostly on the boat over, we went the northern route, and it was so stormy. He couldn't hardly keep the boat in the water. So I didn't learn much German. And it was so stormy when we got to Rotterdam, or Amsterdam, whatever it was. It was so cold, I went into the big department store and bought me a coat. Well, that was some coat. It was pure wool. Rough sort of wool, green, long, and I paid $13 for it. That thing would last me until now. I don't know what happened to it, but it would still last me. It had it, and I wore that thing all summer. It was cool, a pill. The food is soft by grateful things. Wohnstorf by Hanover. Wohnstorf. There was an old 11th century church there. We went every Sunday. With those blocks, rocks, what do you call them? Like the streets. I don't know how you managed to sit through the whole service because there's no heat in it.
Mm.
Well, I have a very pleasant recollection of it. I would, but you see, now here's the thing. You see, you don't know what to look for. Now it's like this boy, this freshman. I got to talking some of my talk, you see that, and he came by the office one day. Nice fellow, you know, you heard me say that. And he said he would just, he just had enough of it here. And just as soon as he could get loose, he was going to travel. He was going around the world in a sloop. I thought there was something peculiar about it. I kept thinking, well, what in the hell is a sloop? And then I saw that it didn't matter. What could he see in a sloop? Now that's, you see, that's the blunders you see people make. That's the blunders. You see, I was gone, I don't know how long I was out of this country. I was gone over 2 years out of this country in World War II. And I was in all those places. And I tried desperately and manfully to see things that Mark Twain had seen. And it saved me. I couldn't see them. I can see them now. I can just walk around some little old no-count road. I can see the same things he saw roughly. If I saw him, I couldn't make anything of it, you see. Now, see, I had to sit here knowing all that before Christmas. And just watch your innocence go off on your travel.
I didn't know what was coming.
And you see, I've been a tramp more than you'll ever be. Now, you may be a better tramp than I was, but you won't be a more extended tramp. And all the time I struggled, I did my darndest. Faith got the letters up there that I wrote home. I wrote long letters. I went out to the village and stopped to see the headman of the village, and we cleared the table and had tea in China. Out on the Burma Road and all those things, you see. I was doing my best. And this fellow that turned up here the other day, I wasn't here, fortunately, and Rick was here.
Oh, yeah.
He looked like an umbrella man. Umbrella fixer. What did he look like, Rick?
What did he look like?
He had cameras in every pocket, and three or four hung around his waist. And he said, let me take a picture. And he took picture one, put it down in each of his pockets, took out a little bit of it, took it and resistant tape color, and pulled this one up and takes that. And he says, well, I like to have a shot of a chimney move over. This one takes a real nice little picture. And took a picture of me with that. Had a vest on. And I thought, well, your hunter's there. Because it looked like you could stick bullets in a single bullet. Only he had pens and pencils in there. He had one of every pen and pencil of every kind in the market. Just plain pencils, ballpoint pens, water pens, ink pens, every color pencil you can think about.
He flew in. Took pictures of bridges.
Yeah.
He stopped down at this little strip down here. And I got up here. He bought a general Jeep, just like he used to do.
I asked him, is this car? He said, no, I just, this one's up there, and I just bought it. Oh. And he took off his shirt. He had an undershirt and a plain shirt, and then he put on a flannel jacket. Then he put on his pencil bag. Then he put on a coat. Then he put a heavy coat on over that, wrap around his neck. And found out later, he was on his way to Vancouver. And just stop by.
just detour slightly. I talked to him on the phone. I said, Dan, you don't come down here for unless you can stay a day or two. Well, he didn't say yes or no, but then he turned out I wasn't here. So Rick, he couldn't get back for a day or two before Thanksgiving. I don't know whether he'll turn up again or not. My big boner was, I didn't ask him where in the hell, what sort of post office address he had.
Scotland, he said.
That's what he said, but I don't know if it was true.
He's going to land in a helicopter, have you?
Yeah, I've been helicoptering pretty fast.
But he was on my buddy.
And the whole time, he just about wrote down everything I said. He was amazing. As soon as he got out of the car, he was looking around. Yeah, if I can put a helicopter right over there, I can land there. And I'd be talking to you. That's it. And ask the questions. And let me write this down. And just say anything. Anything I said. Oh, it just impressed me. Oh, it did impress me.
He didn't eat food.
Whatever the next time. He doesn't even know. You know, what just the thing is near his chin, what he eats. He'll just keep eating that, you know. And then you're up on the table, he won't matter. He'll eat it or not eat it. It's just, he's too busy talking, paying attention to what
he says. He liked Kurt. He liked Kurt in Conrad's story, the one on the
Heart of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness. Except Kurt got in trouble, you see. But Kurt got me with all of them. And then he had all the time people on his side. And so this Carl Eber.
Mm-hmm. He got out of the car, he was talking.
Yeah.
And in a few moments, I kind of felt like I was the visitor and he was the one to listen.
That's right. So we came up with this is really in a stage. He didn't know he was anywhere around, you know. He didn't know this guy talked to him on the telephone that night. He called, you know, from New York and said, Guy, get ready, I'm coming down for you. For the 14th Air Force dinner in Seattle. I'll take run you out there, fly you out there. I heard Guy say, well, I don't want to go. Well, I'll be there anyway. You need to go. You need to see the fellas. I said, I don't want to, Carl. Don't come down here.
One time I said, Carl, I haven't been out of Alaska County in 10 years. And he said, what's that?
This is old buddy in China.
He told me he had a car, Mercedes-Benz in Brunswick. He said, I'm welcome to use it. Just like, you know, I'm just off to Brunswick and drive a car around. I said, Brunswick, Georgia? I was thinking maybe Brunswick's a little town. Huh? You want to show us where he lived in Scotland, so it only took about 5 hours and fly over there sometime.
The guy in Carl on the 14th Air Force.
Yeah. He's the one that everybody I knew through him. Carl and Madam
For years and years and years after Guy got dead, we'd have somebody at the house in Knoxville all the time almost, because they knew somebody that knew Carl Eber, the new guy from China. You know, Chinese, yeah. People. Oh. The only trouble with Carl is he comes to stay a day and stay 2-3 months.
I tell you, I don't know what happened. I don't know. I don't think it's you the same. And so many things almost panned out, but nothing ever did. Nothing ever did. Now you see, all of that added up together, you see, makes this. And this is the first thing that panned out. And now, I've got some points, see, I don't give a damn what happened to it. I mean, The only thing is, this won't mean anything in writing. You just have to, you have to do it. You go your round. I see Debbie been around with the horses, but she's never been to me. And the only thing out here is, she's so far that's in it, it's worthwhile with those tapes. And she can't listen to them. Not now. It'll be a long time. I mean, you have to work into them. You don't listen to them, you don't hear much.
That's what she was saying. That's why I said it. That in order to, you know, edit the tapes, I had to listen to them. And she had to listen.
Yeah, you gotta live it a while. But now that's, now, but you see, look how much is back of it. I always had a toehold on a campus somewhere. The only place I could make a living, you see. Out of stars. But I was never quite on the campus. Any camera I've ever owned, I was never quite up there on both feet, including here. You see, I came down here in 57, and I'd got my watch, and I was just looking for a place to roost. That's all. And I'd had 10 years' experience as head of a little old apartment, but I'd learned a good deal. And I thought, well, I'll make it all right down there. I know Kirkland and Archie and your daddy, and I knew a lot of people down there. Well, I lasted about 18 months. See, you had that seesaw between Archie and Chase, and if one of them didn't get you, the other would. So that's when I was abandoned, and I took to the Mill Hopper Road. You see, that was my beat, the Mill Hopper Road. I knew all the people who were still native along there. Mr. M.M. Bryant was my, he was the richest one. He'd given somebody, someone had sold off and given away one section of land, and he had a section left, pure land out there. Finest land I've ever seen anywhere. He sold timber off of it. That timber grew so fast, he got a crop every 10 years. And that's where I spent my time. Mill Hopper, up to Lackley, over to Sanity. Then I accidentally found this place down here. I'd never been on it when I bought it. But I did wrong. Up into this last. I don't think it's really ever turned up. Now this is my church, see, I can't make much money. And nobody can make anything out of it but me. Alton says you've done your part for a member of the archive. I say, Alton, if they can't listen to them now, they still can't listen to them 50 years from now. So I turn out to be more important than the records.
upset. You could upset. You could upset a good number of different relations, and they ought to be upset. You see, some of these things is sort of an academic trap. Just like I told you in that little note. That is these things that you see in order to be put down. You go back and forth, so create a vine. Put up a row to top of the hole, you know. And that's your outlook. That is your outlook. And you've got all these little things that people ought to be able to read and can't. You see, the socks I wear. There's a book in there on it, and I'm reading it for the third time. And I still don't have it quite in my mind. You think anybody can read that love letter to you, but it's misled. He's not talking about the love letter to you. He's talking about 50 years is not enough, you see. In other words, what he's facing is mortality. And in the next two or three, you forget about the love letter to you when you think about the mortality. That's what he's got in. And you don't know what to make of it. You can't leave it. You've got you see, you've got all these art forms that nobody can handle. I've taught Keith many times. I still have no idea what he's talking about in those schools. I have no firm hand. I'm not bright, but I'm not dumb. I'm not slow. I work hard, and that's what you face with. There's so many traps, you see. Out here. It's the first time I have ever, you see, Mark Twain, I couldn't make it. It looks like anybody could sort of follow in his footsteps, and he couldn't do it as well. I couldn't. I went further, you see, with Ratliff and the Hamlet. And I can see things now that the others don't know. But it's in it. And Faulkner put it in it. And that Radley thing is one of the most fascinating things. And Flynn Snow. You see, they say about Flynn, you see, that he represents the new forces of evil. He don't represent any forces of evil. He's a good businessman. And Faulkner doesn't know what the forces of evil are any more than you or I. But there's one thing he does to Flynn. It just makes him pure evil. And he takes away his voice. Recording I can do that I learned from the countryside. And you see, he has the places, it's all by suggestion. Faulkner doesn't set out anything straight forward. But he says in passing, you see, here's the man, here's Ratliff, he sort of thing. And you'll find him squatting around the white part. You see, on white thing. And you'll see him on the veranda, waiting for the breathing of fire. Talking all the time. And you'll see him at the crossroads. Now, what he does is suggest the places, you see, where he has access to talk. He can't talk anywhere, everywhere. And what you gotta do, you gotta put people on your ground where you can talk. You do now. More than then, because now you see, they won't talk. Now, Mr. Weaver comes over here and cuts my hair, except he hadn't done it in a month or two. And we talk that old barbershop talk. And that old barbershop talk was good talk. But now, you see, if somebody like Rick went into that barbershop, and the barber would start talking to him, you see, he'd probably get him to leave. He wouldn't want to hear all that old stuff. So you see, he got no place, no team. So it's hard to live. Hard to live. So what you do, in a way, your horses and your hay equipment, or your language, you use it as bait. You don't make hay. You use the hay making for bait. And you get your talk. You have to provide the occasion yourself. You can do it. If you've got enough that we have in. Take some. But it's really not that. In a way, you can put it in different light. I think the proper light is, you see, that the feel for people, actually it's not feel for talk that's gone, it's the feel for the people. People won't tell you anything, they won't talk about anything. And they're not interested in you or me. I can't talk anything. Nowhere. I've got no audience. What you're doing is sort of restoring people. It's hard to master. They're hard to do. I thought, well, you go ahead with your business and do this rattler thing on the side, but you can't. It's full time. I don't think you can even do it by yourself anymore. You gotta have somebody to run along with you. But it's working. Some of this talk that I've heard on you. It's just unbelievable. It's so beautiful. Just ordinary people like Miss Daisy who can't even read. They have such extraordinary faculty. That's what you see. But I can't put that down in print. You have to hear. I don't think you So you see, all my tramping around, you see, was mostly just a loose end. I was trying to do it, but I didn't know what I was trying to do. And all I've done out here has been just accidental. I pushed, but I didn't know where I was going. I come up against a blank wall where something turned on. I've been stopped, you know, since the fall of 68, no telling dozens of times. I just stopped. Now you see what I ought to be doing, but I can't do it. You see, I ought to, from what I've done, I can do better. But you see, the team's not going with me. I've got nobody to go with me. I can't keep going by myself. Well, there's so many of the little things. Now, you see, so many of them are very simple. Debbie, so many of them are very simple. You see, so many lines come together. You see, I couldn't do this without Emerson, that old feeling of his, you see, that statement in the beginning of nature. You see that the present age doesn't live in itself. It builds sepulchres for the fathers. And there's no reason why we should not have an original relation with the universe. That's the one statement that got the roll. And that's the one statement that got the roll. One thing, you see, we should be able to have our own religious thoughts and not have them 15th hand, you see, from 2,000 years ago. I've never come close to anybody who would pursue that. I couldn't do it for myself. But it opens it up. But one thing you get, you see, almost in those early things of the 30s, you see, they're the ones that count. All those statements are